To better your best and your world, you need to dig deep and grow. Join us as top experts, leaders, and creators uncover powerful insights to help you grow in life and in work. And now, your host, Michael McAvoy. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Dig Deep Grow. This is Michael McAvoy. I'm your host, and we're live today. Dig Deep Grow is all about becoming better, both in a personal way and in your work life. So we're going to be talking about businesses and how they can do better with their customer experience. That's a big driving force in profitable businesses these days. So joining me today is John Goodman. And John Goodman is he's a long-time customer experience expert, probably the best name known in the industry for this. He's just come out with a new book called Customer Experience 3.0, and I'll be asking him about what that means in a few moments. But the book is called Customer Experience 3.0, High Profit Strategies in the Age of Techno Service. So, John, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
Great. Now, John, you've worked with all sorts of businesses, from small businesses to to Fortune 500 businesses. Let's get an overview first of, you know, just how long you've been doing this and why you've gotten into it and how you became the leader that you are in the industry.
Well, actually, one of my associates said that our strategy was what he called systematic serendipity. We actually started out as an ad hoc student group in the basement of Harvard Law School. I was at the business school at the time. And our very first project was for a cabinet officer, Elliot Richardson, under Richard Nixon, who asked us to look at consumer involvement in government programs. And we basically found a mess. And so people at the White House remembered us as telling it like it was, as opposed to how management wanted to hear it. So they asked us to look at the entire federal government and, oh, by the way, also look at 100 private sector companies on how they delivered service, and, oh, by the way, do a cross-section survey of the U.S. population to find out how do consumers behave when they have problems. And what came out of that was we found that when customers have a problem but don't complain, they're much less loyal. But if they have a problem, complain, and are satisfied, they are much more loyal. And they tell a lot of people good things about the company. So that actually instigated creation of the GE Answer Center and the use of 800 numbers for customer service. Since then, we've worked in about 17 countries and worked with 45 of the Fortune 100, but also a lot of very small organizations also. And we find that the basic principles really are identical whether you're a Fortune 500 company or a small business. It's just how you go about executing is certainly different.
Yeah, there's been some discussion about how large companies are like, you know, they're like huge ships, and it's hard to change their way of doing things. In fact, a lot of customers complain because, hey, it's just this monolithic corporation that doesn't really care so much about an individual versus a number or a statistic. So do you find that in the work that you do that it is easier sometimes to deal with a small or turn around a smaller company versus the larger companies when it comes to customer experience?
In general, the answer is yes. I would agree with you, although we have seen some large corporations who can make things happen very quickly. And one interesting example, which anyone could implement regardless of size, is at Yahoo. Marissa Mayer has a website on the internal Yahoo website, which is her PB&J site. And that's not peanut butter and jelly. It is problems, barriers, and jams, which if any employee encounters any kind of a broken process, they can say, I'm frustrated with this. And if 100 employees say, yeah, that is a problem, she promises to fix it within 2 weeks. And so I've just worked with a small construction company, and they are basically doing exactly the same thing, where if anyone has a frustration, they send an email to, in this case, it's just a very simple email box, and the CEO promises to look at it. And what's been really neat is that two or three things I raised, he was able to say, okay, we're changing this in the span of 2 or 3 days. And the neat thing about that is that it gives the employees hope that, hey, things actually can change. But you can do exactly the same thing. Fred Smith at Federal Express, we identified some points of pain a number of years ago, and Fred went out with a email and a letter to the employees and the customer base saying, we've identified these four things and we're either not going to do them or we're going to fix them really quickly, and he called it his purple promise. And again, there was the response from the customer base and the employee base was, wow, somebody's actually listening. So you don't need to fix everything or make massive process changes. In many cases, if you just pick one or two frustrations that employees have, employee frustrations overlap customer frustrations by about 70%. You're going to fix something that's going to make everybody say, oh, they're really listening, they care, and it's going to make things more efficient, and it gives them hope. People will give you a lot of rope as long as you show you are listening and you're trying to fix things. So you don't have to fix everything.
Yeah, you said something earlier which is pretty interesting. I want to make sure I have this correct, that people complain. In other words, you're going to need to fix something, that on the other end of that, they tend to be more loyal than just the average customer. Is that what I heard you say?
In many cases, that's true. And in fact, in a lot of data, we see that the customer can be as much as 8 points more loyal than if they had no problem. Now, I've had executives in some companies look at that data and say, gee, maybe we should create a small problem for each customer so he can then complain and we can dazzle him with our service and then cross-sell him on something else. Not sure I would do that as an overt. I had another executive who said, don't worry, we create enough problems without that. But the basic point is that if you are responsive, given this era of unresponsiveness in general, and we've actually replicated recently, my company CCMC has been replicating the White House study that was done 30 years ago every 2 years. We call it the National Rage Study. And what we have found is that service is actually worse now than it was in the 1970s in terms of the number of serious problems people have and their ability to actually get things fixed. It's worse now. And companies are spending tens of billions of dollars, but they're spending it in all the wrong places and not being very successful. And as you alluded to much earlier, they're not allowing their frontline employees to use their brains to actually fix things.
Okay, now that there's a very interesting point you make. You say that it's less, there's less efficiency, there's more disgruntled customers, and you know, on the surface, you would think, well, hey, we've got all these tools that we never had before. We can keep on top of our connections, our touches with customers so much better. You know, to me, it sounds like it should be a cakewalk to have a good experience. So, what is the problem? Since we have all these tools at our disposal, why is it like it is, as you just described?
It's because each of these is implemented in a vacuum, and people are thinking about efficiency, and in some ways I blame the finance people, and we can come back to that. But a good example is you put in a phone tree, and Tom Peters actually did an interview with me a number of years ago entitled Push 1, Push 2, Push 3, Push Your Customer Over the Edge. Mm-hmm. And we find phone trees just turn people into angry customers. They started out calmly, and by the time they're through the phone tree, they're angry. And it's because it's very poor design, but there are no-brainers, such as wherever you print the 800 number, you print the menu the customer is going to encounter. And that way I don't need to listen to the options. But marketing says, oh, but that's valuable real estate. We don't want to spend space printing the menu. Mm-hmm. We want to tell you how wonderful life's going to be. And so in many cases, the technology is just poorly implemented, or the other big thing with CRM systems and all the other computer systems is that they aren't interconnected. So you get messages that don't tell you what's actually going on. And one of the big prerequisites we've seen that leads to just a fabulous experience is if the CRM system is tied into all the operating systems of the company, so that, using FedEx as an example, FedEx knows 10 hours before you do that the package isn't going to arrive because it missed the flight in Memphis. Mm-hmm. Then they get the frantic phone call. Then 2 days later, they do the satisfaction survey. Now, we actually have an article that says stop doing surveys to get answers to questions you already have. But my point is that they have internal operation systems that say, oops, in 10 hours, it's not going to be delivered. So what they now do is they use the operating system to drive the CRM system to reach out to you and say, we've got bad news, it's not going to arrive, but if you have it in soft copy, go to the nearest FedEx Kinko's, we'll rebuild it, and it will arrive. So you take a disaster and turn it into a, wow, you guys are really good.
Right, yeah, kind of doing it ahead of the customer is probably the best approach there.
Anticipation.
Yes.
And this is a concept that I call psychic pizza, which is I ring your doorbell and say, here is the pizza or the service or information you were about to ask for.
Yeah, that would be pretty impressive, I think. So
the basic problem, back to your question, is that people really haven't thought through. The IT people are implementing in a vacuum, and each of these systems is implemented separately. But when it's all tied together, and the Cheesecake Factory is sort of an interesting example, where they've tied the end-to-end customer experience into a single system that talks to each other all the way through the system, then you can get a really great experience.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's go back to the name of the book now. It's called Customer Experience 3.0, and explain to me what the 3.0 means.
Well, there's been an evolution, again, going back to the 70s, which is probably before most of your listeners were born. In the 70s, there was TQM, Total Quality Management, and Customer Service. Then in the 90s, a guy named Joe Pine wrote a book called Customer Experience, and he said, you need to wow your customers. And that was the primary message. Then I came up with the concept of strategic customer service. It says you need to listen to your customers and have a good feedback system. Then in the early 2000s, IBM and some other companies started talking about customer experience 2.0, which is let's use CRM systems, customer relationship management systems, to tailor the offering to the customer, but it was primarily for sales. And this is where you personalize the website or personalize the offer.
Mm-hmm.
I've now gone to customer experience 3.0, which is, in addition to personalizing the sales experience, you are proactive, preventive, and create emotional connection end-to-end, because we find that what happens after the sale takes place is even more important than how the sale itself takes place.
Okay, yeah, that's a very interesting point there. I've heard it said, you know, there are three elements of the customer experience. One is before the sale, during the sale, and then following the sale. If you were going to advise just a startup or a small business, we could take a niche maybe like a restaurant or something like that, and you wanted to tailor, you know, the dream come true experience, do you propose that it's a good idea to go and say, well, let's think about what that dream come true experience would be? Would you lay it out from beginning to end, or do you?
Absolutely.
Okay, so talk a little about how you would do that.
Basically, what one needs to do, whether it's a restaurant, a car dealer, a software company, or a delivery company, you basically say, what's the first message that the customer is going to see where we create awareness, and then you go through, as you just said, the sales process, the actual delivery of the product, and then the use of the product. And in each of those areas, you basically map that out using process mapping to say, what are all the places where we touch the customer? What are all the places where the customer is going to be doing something with our product? And what are all the possible things that can go wrong? And here, it's not necessarily what your employees are doing. We find another myth is everyone assumes if you have a dissatisfied customer, it's because Mary Lou, your frontline employee, must have done something wrong. We actually find that the customer causes 30% of all his own problems by failing to read the directions and making incorrect expectations. And marketing and sales creates another 30% by not warning the customer about the attributes of the product. For instance, at the Cheesecake Factory, one of the things that the server does is they take you on, as they call, a tour of the menu. And they talk about, okay, the sweet tea, now this is mango passion fruit. Have you had this tea? Because not everybody likes it. this particular dish is spicy. Do you really like spicy? And so they are sort of warning the customer. And a lot of marketing people say, good grief, we don't want to say anything negative about the product, but it's very important to warn the customer. So we find one of the best ways of enhancing the customer experience is just to educate the customer about, here are our products, here's our process, here are the limitations to that process. And while marketing and sales hate the idea of talking about the limitations, the customer's reaction is, wow, you cared enough to take the time to warn me about this, and it's actually a delighter. So you map the entire experience, but we find that the areas that are given the least attention and are the biggest, cheapest opportunities, whether it's a small or large business, is, are you honestly marketing and warning customers about possible drawbacks, and also warning customers about some of the mistakes that they can make and how to avoid those mistakes?
Get this podcast delivered to you automatically. You can subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, and more. You'll find the links here or on our website, digdeepgrow.com. Okay, so now you've given an example of the Cheesecake Factory, which is a fairly large company. Can you talk a little about, let's say that you came into a car dealership, in a local area, and they said, you know, we're getting all these complaints. We're doing the best we can. We're selling vehicles, but we're not creating the experience that we want. What would you do? How would you take them through your process?
Okay, again, and I've actually done this with a local Mercedes dealer, and we've done it with Ford dealers also, is you start identifying where are the unpleasant surprises. And one of the big unpleasant surprises is the customer walks in and says, I need a tune-up. And the service writer writes, customer wants tune-up. You then do the tune-up, and they say, but it's still making that same noise. And so Ford actually put together a little brochure, and again, we've done the same thing with a sign on the wall that says, is it a rattle or a click? Our service writer is going to interrogate you about exactly what the car is doing, because we have to get the right information from you so that we can properly repair the car. Mm-hmm. Another example, standard point of pain in auto repair is the customer gets his invoice and they then see the labor rate is $110 and they freak out. $110, that's outrageous. Mm-hmm. And so what we now have in the customer waiting area and behind the cashier is we have a large sign that says, our labor rate is only $110, and here's what you're getting for it. You're getting 100 loaners. You're getting $1 million in parts. You're getting 8 certified technicians. And then at the bottom we say, and by the way, your plumber is $165.
Okay.
We're cheap.
Yeah.
We find the best defense is a good offense. Be upfront with the customer and warn him about the sweet tea or the labor rate. And what we find is customers will play by the rules if you tell them what the rules are. But people, many entrepreneurs are reticent to talk about the downsides because the sales literature says, you know, always be positive. Well, customers are so cynical now, they want to have a full disclosure, and they give you extra points for that kind of a full disclosure.
Right, and you know, if you do share your rate and it's just way out of what they were comfortable with, that, well, then maybe they shouldn't be buying that item or be there for that, you know, sale. So it's just that, again, that could lead to a sale later because they didn't get all hot and bothered after the fact, right?
And I actually have a perfect example that I had a small investment company where a customer called up and said, I want to make this investment, and the advisor looked at their whole financial profile and said, you know, I don't think I'd make that investment. I'd pay off your credit card bills. And the customer later wrote in the survey, he was really angry because it was sort of like your mother telling you to clean your room.
Yeah.
And he said, I was mad for about 2 minutes, and then it occurred to me that they were foregoing the sale for my best interest, and I will be a customer of theirs for life. So even saying no to the customer is where you forego a little bit of revenue right now, on the other end, it can have a huge payoff.
Wow. Okay. So I'm going to ask you a question about the best balance between using the new tools and social media, et cetera, that we can use these days. But the first question I wanted to, before I forget, is about the biggest source of problems that you experience. I'm sure you have a whole checklist of things and where the problems come from, whether they're generated from a phone call or a web visit or these kind of things. Can you point to one, two, or three maybe of the top areas where it's like the low-hanging fruit if you fix it?
Yeah, one of the very first is the website, and even the smallest companies now have websites. And almost every website is mismatched to who's visiting it. And what I mean by that is all websites are marketing oriented. The homepage in most cases is 90% marketing, and there's some little box that says for service or contact us or website map at the top, but it's almost all marketing. If you actually look at who is visiting most websites, 80% of the visitors are people who have already bought your product and want to know where is it or how do I use it or what else do you have in this area. And what we find is that most organizations make it very hard to get serviced on the website. Now, one of the best approaches is for whatever the top five questions that your service area is finding that customers are asking, you place those five answers on the home page. And immediately you'll see customers won't be calling about it because 20-somethings especially, but pretty much all of us now, go to the website before we would ever bother calling, because calling is perceived as being somewhat of a hassle. So to the degree that it's on the website, it immediately gets fixed. The other thing that almost no one does is the website map is should be an index to every question I could possibly have. And we find in most cases the website map is very hard to find. It's in fine print at the bottom of the page as opposed to in big print at the top of the page. And to the degree that the website map has hyperlinks to all the FAQs of everything I want to know, more than likely I'm going to service myself, and people are happy doing that. So that the website is one of the biggest things. The other thing is a welcome package that whenever a customer buys any product that is more complicated than a bottle of soft drink or something, you need to provide them with some information on it, and you have to assume that they're not going to read a big thick manual. So what we find is a welcome email or a welcome quick start, one page that has four or five bullet points. You can't educate people on everything, but four or five things you can. And a sort of an interesting example, which also gets into prevention, is we had a small insurance company that for homeowners policies, it had a limitation of if your house burned down or was flattened by a tornado of $5,000 worth of jewelry. And it turns out a lot of consumers have more than that. And so if the claim was then denied, well, you were a bunch of crooks. You didn't warn me about this. Well, didn't you read your policy? No, no one reads their policy.
Yeah.
So what they did in the welcome letter is they said, welcome to the family. We cover just three things you need to know, one of which is we only cover up to $5,000 worth of jewelry. And again, sales says, oh, why are we talking about the downside? Well, the customer's reaction is, oh, well, I have more than that. I guess I need to buy a rider. Can I give you some more money?
Right.
So we avoid the problem at the same time that we actually generate more revenue. So some type of a very simple welcome package that the customer's already bought. They're not going to tear up the contract, but now you have warned them about the two or three most prevalent unpleasant surprises. The last area is checking back with the customer to see how they're using the product. And we find that whether it's your automobile dashboard, which is now very complicated with all the computers, or I had a software company that was selling software to nonprofits, and at my suggestion, 3 weeks after the software had been delivered, they actually reached out through the web to see, was the software actually being used? And what they found was a third of the clients hadn't started using the software.
Right.
And what we found was, if after 3 weeks you haven't used it, there's about a 50% chance you're never going to use it. You're going to cancel your subscription the next chance you get. Mm-hmm. And in most cases, it was because people were overwhelmed by the complexity, and so they started doing welcome calls at 10 days saying, hi, we notice you haven't really started using the software. Do you have some questions? And all of a sudden, you could then get people to start using your software.
Right. So again, it's back going back to architecting that experience so that you're basically anticipating what the average person is going to do, and that maybe not even open the box. So getting them to consider.
Or if they do, they won't read the directions.
Right. Yeah. So on that point, you're educating the customer. So what in today's age, and you can talk about the different age groups too, demographics. What's the best way to educate? Is it through PDFs? Is it through sending direct mail pieces? Is it video? What's the best way to educate your customer these days?
You've just hit the nail on the head. It's video. What we are now finding is that almost anyone will watch a video if you portray it as, hey, this is 30 seconds or a minute long, and this will tell you how to get started. And the key thing is that most of the world says, well, if a one-minute video is good, a five-minute video must be better. Wrong.
Mm-hmm.
What we find is that people's attention span is one minute to 90 seconds. And two very interesting examples. One, Zipcar has a series of videos on using different aspects of their product. One that is my favorite is how to extend your car for a couple of hours, and it's a about a 70-second video that is a mini soap opera where this young woman is going to meet a new boyfriend, and he has a picnic spread out, and her facial expression says, ooh, this is going to be nice, but ooh, I'm going to need more time. And then the narrator comes on and starts saying, here's how you do the extension. So she's surreptitiously doing it with her smartphone, and then the narrator starts eating the grapes in the picnic, and it's hilarious, and it's entertaining. And then at the end, the last 15 seconds, they say, now, did you get that? Here are the four learning points that we wanted you to get.
Mm-hmm.
And it's enough fun that people will then watch the next 60-second tape.
Right.
And this is what Tesla has done that's so brilliant, is they've got 28 minutes of educational video on this $100,000 car, but they have broken it into 16 chunks.
Mm-hmm.
So that none of them are more than a minute and a half, and people will tolerate that. And the best example is Lowe's, the home improvement company, is now using Vine, which is it's a video tool that has the maximum length of the video is 6 seconds. And they can show you how to repair something at home. My favorite is that in 4.8 seconds, they show you how to get the crud off your shower head.
Mm-hmm.
And they go through the entire process in 4.8 seconds.
That's amazing.
So, and I use that as an example of you don't need a lot of time to show how to do something, and it doesn't need to be Hollywood quality. In fact, if it's rustic, it works better because people, you know, sort of can feel like it's something that they would do.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, so you kind of piqued my interest with the Tesla example. So you have 16 chunks of small video. I'm sure that the people, customer experience department, would want to have those people consume as much of that as possible. So how do they show that, or how do they lead people through it? Is it like, okay, if you like that, watch the next video, or do they just show a menu of the videos?
Well, it's a combination of, you know, here's the next one. They sort of tell you what the next follow-on one is, and it's almost sort of like in some of the crime shows, they have a teaser to get you, you know, there's somebody's on the ledge, you know, at the end of this show, so you got to tune in next time to see what happens next. But there's also a combination of a very clear menu, so that if I have a particular issue, I can go right to that, and especially with my iPad or whatever, and if memory serves right, I think they even give you an iPad that has everything preloaded on it for $100,000. They probably should. And So I can go to exactly what I need if it's sort of, okay, how do I get the spare tire out of the trunk? You know, because I'm befuddled by that. I can go directly to that. Or, depending on your proclivity, you can actually watch the whole thing in sequence if you want.
Right.
Another interesting thing is that, and this is where wireless and mobile come in, is that the car companies are now considering monitoring your utilization of the command center on your dashboard, which has 25 functions, of which you know how to use 4 or 5 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And at my suggestion, what they are doing is they are actually monitoring what you're using and then sending you an email or whatever your preferred approach is, a text saying, hey, we notice you're not using these 2 functions. These might make sense. Here's a 45-second video on how to use it. Now, the interesting downside that a couple of the car companies have raised is, people are going to think we're monitoring their behavior and we're spying on them. Well, yes, there are a few people who will be concerned about that. I ran into a problem with a power company in Orange County, California, doing that, because we went out to people and said, we know you're using more electricity than you normally do. Your bill is going to be higher. And while 30,000 people said, thank you so much, we did have 5 people who said, you're spying on me. But at the same time, yeah, that allows you, by you knowing what your customer's doing with the product, you can then tell them, here's how you get more value, because the more functionality that they use in the product, the more they're willing to pay for it, and the happier they're going to be, and you can raise your margins.
Okay. Now, I'd say something like 70% of the businesses in the country are 1 to 3 people, so these are mostly smaller-sized businesses. What are the things that these people can do? They don't have the bank of cash that large companies do to really do the things that some of the things you've talked about. You know, what are the most profitable, the easiest things that they can implement?
Okay, I would say the most important thing is the assume your customers don't fully understand your product and spend a little bit of time educating them, and then coming back to them a week or two later with a quick, and what you can do is ask them, what's the preferred way of communicating with you? I know a lot of people don't, you know, want telephone calls because they're invasive. Mm-hmm. Could I send you a text message in a week asking if you have any questions or how things are going?
Mm-hmm.
And those two, the setting proper expectations, warning them about 2 or 3 things, giving them a one pager. And by the way, it can be very, very simple. We had an insurance company where a particular form filled out by agents and customers always had mistakes, which mucked up the works tremendously. We had a post-it note at the top that said, here are the 3 most prevalent mistakes people make on this form.
Hmm.
And immediately those 3 mistakes went away.
Wow.
People will play by the rules. So and there it was just literally a post-it note. So a lot of this stuff can be very low tech.
Yeah.
And depending if you've only got, you know, 20 customers a week, you can do this education face to face or over the phone or send them a text message. So
right. So
the setting proper expectations, doing the welcome package, but then even 3-person firms now have websites, and a way of leveraging your efficiency is to create an FAQ section that says, here are the 10 questions we always get asked, mm-hmm. and here are the answers to those. And we find people are paranoid about, oh, well, if I'm talking anything downside on my product, you know, that's going to be negative. But people love hearing reality.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I have a construction company that is now educating consumers on a home improvement, whether it's a bathroom or a kitchen or whatever, that here's going to be your emotional reaction during this project.
Mm-hmm.
And when we get everything torn up, but there's, you know, the plumbing's not installed yet, you're going to be depressed and upset, and we know you're going to be. And ServiceMaster, sort of a really stark example of ServiceMaster, has identified that everyone has a miserable time when their hot water heater goes out. So whenever they get a work order where they're going to have to replace someone's hot water heater, they immediately send an email that says, we're sorry to hear you need to have your hot water heater repaired, and it's going to be 2 days of cold showers, and we apologize in advance. And sending that email raised customer satisfaction 20 points.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I'd imagine they'd probably even go higher if they found some way of putting a portable in. But
Exactly. But the basic point, it's sort of like the airline pilot who gets on it. If he says we have a 1 hour delay due to a mechanical, there are a bunch of foul ups. If he says we have a leak in the hydraulic system, everyone says, you know, I want a good hydraulic system, take an extra half hour. We joke about at Lexus that when you're saying no to the customer or giving him bad news, the object of the game is to tell the customer to go to hell in such a way that he looks forward to the trip. So I guess the other thing that anyone could do, even if you're a one person, is have clear, believable explanations for why you're doing what you're doing, and when problems arise, you know, how you're going to respond to the problem. And what we find is 98% of the world is reasonable. So if you give them a clear, believable explanation, or you give your frontline employee a clear, believable explanation, the customer will accept it. Where you get into trouble is when you tell the employee to say this to the customer, but you don't give them the rationale behind it. Mm-hmm. So if the customer then says, well, why are you doing that? Why can't you do this for me? The only answer the employee has is, look, Mac, that's our policy, which comes across as rudeness, except in New York. Or worse, they'll side with the customer and say, yeah, that is a stupid policy. I don't know why we do it that way. I work for a stupid company. So the critical thing is to ask your frontline employees, what are we telling you to tell the customer that you can't defend? Because if they can't defend it, they're giving one of those two answers.
Right. So you've said this actually over and over again. It's like, even if it seems like it's not the right thing to do, if you're honest and human, it's actually going to be perceived as a positive for you and your company.
And I actually had a small business in Providence, Rhode Island 3 days ago where the CEO said, you know, we made this bag that actually was for the military. So it was very, very strong. It was a bag for carrying things. And it was sort of had a, sort of a rough outside. And we've started selling it now to women to carry their stuff to the yoga session or whatever. Uh-huh. And we because it was rough, it was scraping their skin. And so we were going to we've made a cover, smooth cover to go over it, and we were going to sort of raise the fact that, hey, the basic bag is kind of rough, and the marketing people didn't want to mention it. And she said, but I sort of put my foot down, and we broadcast this on the website, and the reaction has been, hey, yeah, this was an issue, but they've responded to it, and aren't they wonderful? Mm. So, and she said, you've just validated what I did, but I was very worried when I did it.
Wow. So did they, if I heard you correctly, did they offer a second version or some sort of upsell for the bag?
Well, no, they basically came up with a cover for it.
Okay.
Because, again, this thing will stop a 50 caliber bullet. But, you know, women want to use it to carry their yoga pants. And but it was rough. So they basically then took this military equipment and put a stylish cover on it. Mm-hmm. And now they've got a whole new market.
Wow. There you go. All right. John Goodman, the book is Customer Experience 3.0. I'm going to ask a couple more questions, John, if that's okay with you.
That's great.
First is the balance that a company needs to use between all these different communication mechanisms, phone, text, social media, email. Can you draw a little bit of a example of, you know, does everybody use the same one, or how does a company find the balance between these?
You have just hit the key thing, which is one size does not fit all. We find that there are, I'm going to get make somebody mad on this, but there are AARP people who don't use computers, and there are a bunch of 60-plus people who are more tech-savvy than you and I. We find some people want to do everything by text. A lot of people are into email. A lot of people view telephone calls as invasive. So it's basically you need to have all the different channels available. And while I am not a huge fan of social media from the perspective of I think it's very inefficient to service people via social media, you have to be paying attention to it. But the idea of telling people, if you've got a problem, tweet us, isn't necessarily the best approach, because in many cases you're not going to get enough detail in 140 characters. So you need to have all the channels open, but make sure that the easiest channels, such as email and telephone, are easily accessible, because if you have a 10-minute wait on the phone, all of a sudden people are going to start tweeting you, and it's dramatically less cost effective to try and service somebody by Twitter than it is by telephone or email.
Yeah, it might actually even be a good idea for, you know, as they do sometimes in the customer on the telephone queue, they'll tell you, you know, 2 minutes or, you know, 3 minutes wait. You could do that for the different mediums, you know, that you have, chat.
Well, and in fact, you've also hit another very important point. The whole telephone service system has been revolutionized in the past 2 years by something called virtual queue. And just about anybody now can buy a system that says the wait time is now 3 minutes. You can either hold for 3 minutes or push one and we'll call you back in 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And what we find is that if I'm going to call you back in 3 minutes, and I actually do because the system actually works, I completely eliminate the dissatisfaction of the hold, and we find that people are willing to wait 7 or 8 minutes in that case with no discernible dissatisfaction, because, gee, I can go to the bathroom or I can go get a cup of coffee, and then I know you're going to call back in 7 minutes,
right.
And it completely dissipates the dissatisfaction of the queue. But I would say less than about 15% of companies are using that virtual queue technology now.
Well, I know for myself, having been in on those calls, when they say, or just leave us a message and we'll give you a call back, probably doesn't cut it, but if I hear, hey, it's only going to be 5 minutes and we'll give you a call back, then I'll hang up the
exactly.
phone. I've got other things to do. So, all right. So,
well, you've highlighted one of the key things, which is people hate uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And so to the degree that you can eliminate the uncertainty, you basically eliminate most dissatisfaction.
Right. Okay. So the last question, and this is one you may have had some experience with your clients, and it's kind of a big news item, and that's that the cat is out of the bag with hacking and credit cards. You know, the Targets and the Home Depots of the world are, you know, having big reputational hits, you know, when 5 million or 20 million or 40 million credit cards get hacked and stolen. Have you given any counsel to any of these companies about how to deal with that?
Do you mean once it's happened? Or?
Yeah. Well, prevention is another question. But, yeah, after it's happened.
Yeah. The key thing is to be as transparent as possible and as fast as possible. It's much better if they hear it from you than they hear it on the news. And in fact, my wife had a credit card at one of the retailers who was hacked, and she didn't hear from them for about 2 or 3 weeks. And again, it's the uncertainty issue of, am I one of the ones? Do I need to, you know, be really looking at my credit reports and everything to see if somebody's opening new accounts? And so the minute that you get a glimmer that there is some type of an issue, it's better to warn people. And again, I would draw a parallel with airline pilots and air traffic delays and such. The more they communicate and the faster they communicate, the better people feel about it.
Great. Okay, so the book is called Customer Experience 3.0, High Profit Strategies in the Age of Techno Service. And we've had John Goodman joining us today. Just a lot of great answers. And the takeaway that I get is it's not so difficult to actually make a huge difference both in your profitability and in the happiness of your clients. So, John, I appreciate you joining me today.
Hey, my pleasure. I really much enjoyed the conversation. Thank you very much.